Stamford, Connecticut was where I was mm-hmm. born. And I'm in Connecticut still. And now I enjoy my own children, who are getting older, still picking a bouquet of lilacs. And
mm-hmm.
to make my day, it's just my kids and a bunch of lilacs. And that's
oh,
all.
That's wonderful.
And mass, of course. But that's all I need, you know, just to have them with me. And maybe if they can scrounge up some lilacs, that'd be nice. But, of course, they do more than that. And it's a blessed day for mothers, you know, of all mothers of all kinds.
I bet. I suspect your kids did this. I know my kids have done it, and I did it as a kid. Because mom was so special, we picked some of the neighbor's flowers without knowing we weren't supposed to do that.
It's so funny you should mention that, Bob, because quite a few years ago, my older kids put up my younger Joseph at the time to go to the neighbor's yard and grab some of their lilacs. I didn't know anything about it, but I heard all about it later, and Joseph got into trouble. The guy came out and yelled at him. And poor Joseph said, "I'm just getting these for my mother."
Well, it's one of those really difficult things. We've probably all faced it, where a kid does something out of pure love.
Yes.
Like you know, walking along and sees these beautiful roses or whatever it is, petunias or something, and picks mm-hmm. them, hands them to mom, and mom knows that they just got picked from the neighbor's front yard where their prized roses, and it really puts you in this odd. You don't want to scold them. You don't even want to rain on their parade in any way, because
right.
they pick up in a hurry. You say, "Thank you, honey. That was sweet, but we don't pick the neighbor's flowers." And
yeah, you can't do that.
No, their little chin drops on their chest, and you go. So, how do you handle that?
Oh, you're asking me, huh?
Well, you're it's Mother's Day, and you're a mom.
Well, I think you just give them a big hug and a kiss, and you run out as soon as you can and buy a plant for your neighbor. And then you can just go over it and give it to them and say, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I had no idea that he was going to pick your flowers, but here, this is for you." And just give them a big flower with a big smile on your face, and then what could they do?
That's good. And then the next Mother's Day, they steal the neighbor's car and give it to you.
Oh, I don't think we want it. Well, you do eventually have to explain to them.
That's right.
They cannot take it. You just don't want to spoil that moment. But later on, you, of course, tell them that, you know, we have to pick from our own yard.
it is phenomenal what's in the hearts of little children for their mom.
For sure. And vice versa, what mothers will do for their for their children. You know, it's just such a beautiful vocation, and we celebrate mothers all over. It's not just a Hallmark holiday. It's just a beautiful day to celebrate mom.
Well, and you know, the interesting thing is, and I don't know if you've followed the news in the last day or two, but Time Magazine has come out with a sort of a provocative cover and this whole thing about super parenting and super moms. But the thing that I'm intrigued by is that Time thinks this is a relevant topic today.
Oh.
You know, which I think is real good. I mean, people talking about motherhood and you know, it's like these are sort of extreme parenting type stuff
okay.
but it's opened the conversation whether or not you sort of Time doesn't really have a position on it. They're just introducing this extreme parenting, and what do you think about it?
What do they call extreme parenting? Being there for your kids?
Oh, well, I mean, on the cover of the magazine is a picture of a young mom breastfeeding a kid who is over 3 years old.
Over three.
Almost
okay.
four. And, it's a fairly graphic photo right on the cover.
Oh.
And the kid is standing on a chair. You know, I mean, he's
clear. Oh,
he's not, he's not a baby.
Yeah, but I know. But you see, they did it in that way just to really.
Indeed, they did.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, there are parents that nurse their children into toddlerhood. I nursed mine into toddlerhood, but they never stood on a chair, and they weren't that old.
And you didn't put it on the cover of Time magazine.
No,
yeah.
No. They're exploiting mothers. That's terrible.
Yeah. So,
and I have to take a look at that.
It's at least creating a chance for, well, you and I are talking about it right now.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's on
You're
the Today
right.
Show. It's everywhere.
You're
you know?
Absolutely right. It's giving us an opportunity to speak about it.
One of those teachable moments.
It is, but you know, this is one of those hot topics, though.
Yeah.
And it's just going to go back and forth, and all over the place. Just have to pray and just keep loving mothers and getting the...
Well, you know, I do think, you know, I mean, you can flip it around and go, what does somebody who just, you know, the Lord works in mysterious ways, somebody who didn't want to be pregnant, just found out they're pregnant, mm-hmm. is considering abortion, and just happens to see this cover of Time magazine.
Right.
And happens to hear turns on the Today Show and sees the conversation about motherhood and how to be this one mom is saying, no, you got to be wear the kid in a sling at all times, and just kind of this extreme, you know, coddling. I don't call it extreme, but
yeah,
a lot of us did that.
They're calling it extreme, but that's what we did. I held my child. I put my child in a backpack when they were older,
sure.
and a front pack when they were younger. And you love your children, and that they need to feel your warmth and that sound of your heart. You know,
absolutely,
and that's wonderful. So why are they calling it extreme?
It's great for dads too. I mean, the baby Bjorns and all that. Just having that kid nestled against you, it's a wonderful bonding.
Absolutely,
moment.
I feel an article coming on, Bob.
Yes, indeed.
I feel many articles.
Yes.
I feel a book coming on.
Well, and the nice thing about it is going back to the, you know, the person who's pregnant and, mm-hmm. and wondering what to do.
Yes.
Is hearing this conversation about extreme parenting or middle of the road parenting or, you know,
natural,
you know, but it's all about
normal.
Parenting. It's all about being a mom and a dad. It's not about an abortion, you know,
that's true.
There are going to be some of those people go, wow, I mean, having a baby is pretty cool here.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's stick with the positive.
Yeah,
absolutely. That's great. So let's hope and pray that it has a good effect on people.
So Mother's Day, it's not a Hallmark day. I think it's great that it's in the month of May, which is also Mary's month.
Absolutely. I wish I remembered where I read something the other day, and it was talking about the person who actually invented Mother's Day, and she was upset that that people were turning it into something like a Hallmark Day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry I don't have the information. My brain is kind of fried at the moment, but it was all about, you know, write your mom out a card, write her a little love note or a letter. Don't just, you know, slap a card down and that's it. And so in that way, it shouldn't be a Hallmark. But I think the people who give the cards to their mothers isn't, you know, they're not just, you know, just going an easy route, just picking up a card. They put thought into what they choose. But I guess the person who invented Mother's Day didn't want it to turn into something crazy. And it's wonderful that it is in the month of May, the month of our Blessed Mother. And, you know, when the rebirth of spring, it's just a beautiful time. And the lilacs come out just in time for Mother's Day.
Yeah, well, you know, I know as a writer myself, I remember one time going to the drugstore, wherever you get the greeting card, and looking through all of them. And, you know, there were these sappy, drippy, always a poem, you know, and everything rhymed and you know, kind of these beautiful but awful sentiments, you know. And I thought, you know, and my mom knew I was a writer, so I just took one of those cards. And I mean, clearly it's you know, manufactured on a formula, and there's a million of these same cards printed, and a million moms are getting the exact same message from their son. And I go through it, and I'd cross out certain words, and I'd say, not my word. My word would have been this, you know, and went through, and it was, I hope, both touching and funny.
That's neat. I wonder.
And she told me years later, as she was declining and you know, showing the grandkids various things from her life and stuff, she hauled out that card and said, this was one of the most special cards I ever got.
Oh, do you have it still?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Did you frame it? I'd stick it in a frame.
Yeah.
And just to preserve it, or just in a nice album or something. Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, that's very
And with, with my own kids, I always tell them, you know, what your mom really wants is something that you made.
Yes.
Whether it's a drawing, whether it's a poem, whether it's just writing down your best memory from the last year or from childhood or something. That's what she wants. She really doesn't want to go out to brunch.
It's nice if she can go out and she doesn't have to cook, but she doesn't expect that. You know, all of my kids, I don't want to single out, you know, because they all did such beautiful, memorable things for me. But so maybe I shouldn't mention the name of the one who did this. I don't know.
I'll go ahead.
Okay. My son, Justin, my oldest, who I have a card in my nightstand drawer, and I have lots of things in my drawers and different places that the kids have given me, and beautiful little sentiments. And well, one card in particular stands out in my mind. I'm just thinking as we're talking now, wasn't planning to mention this, but he wrote something in there like, I don't know what I would do. I don't know what I would do if you weren't in my life. Mom, I love you. What a beautiful thing.
Yep.
And I just hung on to that because it wasn't just the card, but he added that to it. And you know, all the kids have done things like that, and I have beautiful cards for them, but that one I just popped into my mind. So, you know, it just touches a mother's heart just to hear that, because we're so busy. We have such busy lives raising the kids. We're in the trenches of the dishes and demands and diapers and all of the stuff outside of the doors of the home clamoring for our attention. So a lot of times we just kind of get through our days and we love our kids and do all the things we do, but we don't have time to stop and, you know, you don't ask your child, hey, what do you think about me being in your life?
Mm-hmm.
But when they write it down and they give it to you, boy, that touches your heart.
Well, and you know, the other thing that I always tell our little ones is that the one thing that will hurt a mother's heart or a dad's heart is to see our kids fighting or competing with each other.
Oh, that's
hard. Because we love you equally, and it's not even equally. We love you just completely and unconditionally, all of you. And to see one hurting the other in some way with words, you know, hurts our hearts. And so really think about that. And maybe you have to be a parent to realize that. You know, kids can be competitive and you get sibling rivalry and all that stuff.
Right.
But, you know, when you all make a wonderful gift for mom to open, don't start competing about whose gift she's going to open first.
Right.
You know, and it's kind of human nature, I think. But I think it's good for kids to be reminded of that mom and dad really love you. Treat each other the way mom and dad treat you.
Absolutely. That's a beautiful teaching, and to get that to them while they're young. And we have to repeat it. It's not just a one-time teaching. We have to, each time something comes up and there's a little rivalry, we can repeat those words. And
you know, it's right there. It made the top 10, honor your father and your mother.
I know. I love
that
it made the top 10. Absolutely.
Of all the things that could be there, you know, I mean, really, I mean, and you think even you look at all the issues today that somehow, I mean, they're all basically mentioned in some one way, shape or form in the Ten Commandments. But boy, it's right there.
Yeah.
Honor your mother and father.
Right. And in the top five.
In the top five. Yeah.
And, you know, honoring your father and mother isn't just, you know, listening and obeying until you're the age of, you know, 21 or wherever, whatever time you leave the house. It's into their
absolutely
years ahead, you know, to honor them and to take care of them. And some people think, you know, that's it, they're done, and then the poor parents get shifted off to a nursing home or something, when, you know, maybe they need that for the medication and physical, you know, the doctor's attention or things like that. But if it's not necessary, let's not push our mothers who've taken care of you all your lives off to a nursing home.
Yeah, I remember in his later years, my dad, who became, you know, very, very difficult. He had Parkinson's and, you know, just kind of gradually going downhill to where I remember one night and my mom had to be out and I literally spoon fed him.
Aww.
Changed his whatever you call an adult diaper.
Yes, right.
And carried him to bed.
Aww.
And it was in the same house I grew up in, and it
beautiful.
It hit me profoundly that he had done the exact same thing in the exact same house
beautiful.
For me like 50 years earlier.
Oh, how beautiful that you had that experience. It must have been hard, but it was so beautiful that you could give that to your father.
Yeah, yeah, it's
that's what we're supposed to do.
That's right.
That's what our lives are all about. You know, but we hope we can raise our children to remember that, you know, when we get older and we're not able to do certain things, we're going to count on you guys.
Donna Marie, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about the dinner table.
Well, I'm not sure, if you thought we didn't have time, we could save that for next time.
Well, maybe we should. Maybe
yeah,
we should, because we're kind of against the clock, and I hate to rush dinner.
No, yeah, exactly. That's a wonderful way to put it. Yeah, because we could talk about that next time, the beauty and the dinner table and coming together as a family and how to preserve that and even resurrect it if you're losing it in your home. So that'll be something we can look forward to.
Well, that's great. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope on Sunday you get a whole big bouquet of lilacs.
Oh, thank you so much, Bob, and enjoy your family on Mother's Day. And thank you so much again for having me on the show.
Oh, thank you. God bless.
Welcome. God bless you. Take care.
Yeah, we'll talk to you again soon. Donna Marie Cooper O'Boyle, and you can Google that and find all her books, some great books that she has written. A reminder, St. Vincent de Paul is having some great Mother's Day sales. Get on out to the store, 2275 Watt Avenue. They could also use a lot of household goods, anything you have that you think you might be able to sell in the store. Give them a call, 916-972-1212, and they will come and pick it up. They're really in need of a lot of donations now, and they use all the proceeds to help all the wonderful ministries of the St. Vincent. You can't even name all the ministries that they have, but it's great stuff. And they are having a Mother's Day sale. You might be able to pick up something for mom. Take the kids out to the St. Vincent de Paul store and go shopping for Mother's Day. Also, the Sacramento Life Center is preparing for its annual Mother's Day Rose Sale. Volunteers at many of the churches are going to sell long-stemmed red roses for $5 on Mother's Day after Mass to benefit the Life Center. And, of course, Mother's Day is Sunday. They're going to assemble these roses tomorrow at Presentation School from 7 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. They could use some volunteers. You can call Lena, L-I-N-A, Lena, at 916-451-4357 or email her Lena L, L-I-N-A-L, Lena L at saclife.org, SACLIFE.org, and they could use your help. And if nothing else, buy Mom a rose on after Mass on Sunday. Hopefully your parish will be one of those participating, and the proceeds will go to help the Sacramento Life Center. Well, we're pleased and honored to welcome in Jeannie Woodford, who joins us now, and a lot to talk about with Jeannie, now head of the Death Penalty Focus, formerly the warden at San Quentin. Jeannie, a pleasure to have you here on the Bishop's Hour.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your career in the Department of Corrections and how you came to be the warden at San Quentin.
Well, I started at San Quentin in 1978 as a correctional officer, mm-hmm. 2 weeks after graduating from Sonoma State University with a degree in criminal justice. And I worked my way up through the ranks, and in 1999, Governor Davis appointed me as the warden of San Quentin State Prison. And I remained the warden until 2004, when Governor Schwarzenegger asked me to be the director of the California Department of Corrections.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were in college at Sonoma State, were you thinking of a career in corrections?
Actually, I wanted to become a juvenile counselor, mm-hmm. but those positions weren't available. And so I thought it would be interesting to work at a prison for a year or two and gain that experience. And that would help me, I thought, when I pursued my goal of becoming a juvenile counselor. But I fell in love with the work at mm-hmm. San Quentin, and so I remained there for over 26 years.
What was the attraction of the work? What you say you fell in love with it. You're a lifelong Catholic. How did it all mesh together for you?
Well, not everything that you do, all the work that you do within a prison is exciting and joyful, but mm-hmm. there's certainly what I enjoyed about it is all the challenges. I recognized that criminal justice was heading in the wrong direction, and I thought that I could help bring about reform in the criminal justice system over time. I also just like that every day was a new day. A prison is like really running a city. And so you learn a lot about lots of things, healthcare as an example, or, you know, as a warden, you oversee a school. And so there's just so much that you can learn, and it adds to your experience, and hopefully that experience helps you make differences in the world. And so that's really my perspective.
You say that it was going in the wrong direction. In what ways?
Well, we were locking up more and more people and adding greater time to sentences overall. And I recognized that the cost of corrections was just increasing each year. So mm-hmm. as an example, when I became the director of the California Department of Corrections, the budget was about $8 billion. By the time I left, it was nearly $11 billion. Mm. So I recognized that we could not continue down that path because it was far, far too expensive, and we weren't doing the things that work. We need to recognize that the doors of the prison swing both ways. 95% of individuals who enter state prison return to our communities. Mm-hmm. And we weren't doing anything to prepare individuals for returning to our communities.
Yeah, I think in the whole criminal justice, we have everybody from people who will blame it all on their upbringing or whatever, and then you've got people on the other end of the spectrum who say, throw away the key once they break the law, just lock them up and forget about them. And it's exactly my feeling is, hey, most of these people are going to be walking among us again one day, sometimes one day soon. We'd better have them be prepared.
I totally agree, and we also need to hold individuals accountable.
Mm-hmm.
And when you send them to state prison with the only expectation that they're there to do time,
right.
That really isn't holding them accountable. They need to be accountable for changing their lives and being involved in the right kinds of programs to address their issues so that they can return to our neighborhoods able to hold a job and be an appropriate member of society.
If you had a magic wand and Bill Gates funding you, how would you change the correction system?
Actually, I think the California Department of Corrections is really headed in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Through realignment, non-serious non-violent offenders are not going to state prison any longer, and they'll be held locally. And local communities need to get involved in being sure that the right people are being kept in the mm-hmm, county jail, mm-hmm. and those that can be those whose issues can be addressed in a different sort of way are not kept in the county jail, but are put into drug treatment programs or mental health programs. So I do think the state is headed in the right direction, and I'm very pleased. Particularly, the Department of Corrections released their new plan, and I think it's just excellent.
Can the county jails handle this influx?
Well, there's 58 counties, and each county is doing it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the counties that looked at all of the issues that they needed to address are doing a really good job, San Francisco being one of them and some others, Santa Clara County, where they looked at the funding the state gave to them and decided that a substantial percent of that money needed to go to treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so the counties that are looking for alternatives to incarceration, utilizing electronic monitoring as an example, day reporting centers, and using the science of corrections are going to be able to do a great job with this. And it actually will make us all safer.
Very good. Now, when you were at San Quentin, of course, the death penalty is always an issue there and throughout the state. How have your feelings about the death penalty evolved over time?
Well, I was always morally opposed to the death penalty, but I didn't have a passion about that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started in 1978, there were 6 inmates on death row by the end of 1978. And I watched death row grow from that number to, when I left, over 650 people on death row. And, of course, today there's over 720 individuals, mm-hmm. including 20 women, who are housed at CCWF, a prison in the Central Valley. And so, having been a correctional officer, a counselor, and held so many positions that dealt with death row, I think I've seen this issue from every point of view. And as the warden, I carried out 4 executions, so I certainly know what it's like to carry out an execution. And from all that I learned and observed, I know that the death penalty is just ineffective and costly and does nothing to improve public safety.
Leave out any moral belief, religious belief, but just from a practical standpoint, I know the bishops have emphasized this as well what's going to be on the ballot in November, is that it's impractical and it's actually not cost effective. And I think a lot of people, you hear this. Well, it costs $20,000, $25,000, whatever it is, a year to house these people. You're going to house them for 40 years. That's $1 million. How's that not more expensive than executing them?
Well, because with the death penalty, there is so much money spent on trials and investigations, $40 mm-hmm. million dollars a year. Federal appeals cost $14 million each year. State appeals, $58 million each year. And then the housing on death row, $72 million each year. And, there's a study called the Alarcon-Mitchell Report, right. And Judge Alarcon is in favor of capital punishment, mm-hmm. and his law clerk, Paul Mitchell, is not. And so they studied this issue for several years, and they had access to documents that you and I don't get to see regarding the cost. And they concluded that we spend $184 million more per year on inmates on death row than if they had life without possibility of parole. And it involves all the costs that I just discussed, but when also the housing of death row inmates. So death row inmates are single-celled, which means you reduce the capacity of the prison, so that's mm-hmm. costly. They're housed away from the general population, so you're either escorting the inmate to the services like health care, visiting, mm-hmm. legal visits, or you're bringing the services to them. So there's a lot of staff cost involved in managing death row just from the point of view of their incarceration. If they were in the general population, there'd be 2 inmates to a cell. They'd be able to take themselves to services. Mm-hmm. In the general population, they would work. That's a requirement. And they would pay restitution to the victim's compensation fund. Less than 1% of death row inmates work. So there's really no accountability for them. They are really sitting in their cells or out on an exercise yard 7 days a week or in visiting, and all of that is expensive.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but with the death penalty, the appeals are automatic.
Yes.
As opposed to somebody getting a life sentence is not. I mean, many of those are appealed too, but not to the same degree as the death penalty.
Well, that's correct. Anybody that's convicted of a felony can have one appeal at
right.
taxpayer expense, and then after that, you're on your own. And so an individual serving life without possibility of parole will receive one appeal at mm-hmm. taxpayer expense. That's generally over in about 18 months, and the cost of that is very little when compared to the death penalty, where their appeals are ongoing and at taxpayer expense. In essence, if you're on death row, you have an attorney and a legal team for life.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, I was reading, I can't remember the state. I believe it was last week there was an execution, and the man had been on death row for over 30 years.
Yes.
It wasn't California, but I forget where it was. I think it was one of the southern states. But it was just, you just shake your head and say, well, any thought of a deterrent goes out the window.
In fact, there's been a recent report that looked at all the studies regarding the death penalty as to determine whether it was a deterrent or not, and they said there's just absolutely no evidence that it is a deterrent. For a punishment to be a deterrent, it must be swift and certain,
mm-hmm.
and the death penalty is neither swift nor is it certain. It's, as you point out, even in states where they say they do it quicker, it's certainly...
It's still
more
10 or 12
years,
or yeah,
yeah.
or 15.
Yes.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is I think that the more severe the crime, I think you're dealing with people that have gone way beyond the notion of a deterrent, that some of these murders, when you see what's happening, you think, do you think this person even considered the punishment? I've always said if they had the death penalty for drunk driving, it would probably end drunk driving overnight because you're talking about people who would pay attention to a deterrent. But with your average murderer, I mean, you've got a lot more experience than I do, but it seems to me that so many of them are way beyond even thinking about a deterrent.
I think that's true. People just don't consider the consequences when committing crimes like this. And it's important to know that life without possibility of parole is a very harsh punishment. It holds people
yes.
accountable.
Yeah, in fact, some inmates would actually prefer execution.
Many inmates ask for the death penalty because they don't like the thought of life without possibility of parole and because they know that life on death row is easier than it is being in the general population. With
yeah,
other
I think we've
inmates.
Seen, we saw a case like that within the last year where the guy said, no, I want to be executed, knowing that at least for 15 years he's going to be on death row and have an easier life than being in the general population.
That's true. There's been several cases like that.
Tell us about your work with Death Penalty Focus.
Well, I've been here just a little over a year, and Death Penalty Focus has been around for over 20 years, and the purpose of Death Penalty Focus is to educate the public about the death penalty, and it's really about the facts, and it's our goal to replace the death penalty in this state with life without possibility of parole. We also work at the national level and internationally.
You know, I sense that there's some fluidity here among the electorate. People who are, I mean, we know they're hardliners on both sides, but they're I think there's a fairly good sized middle here that are willing to be persuaded one way or another. What's the toughest argument you face in convincing people who might be on the fence to come over to the side of, you know, a life in prison without the possibility of parole as opposed to the death penalty?
Well, I don't know that I can think of a tough argument. Once people get the facts, it's often hard for people to believe that the death penalty costs more than life without possibility of parole.
It is, yeah.
But when you're able to show them the facts and an independent study like the Alarcon Mitchell report, then they, you know, many people say, I still believe in the death penalty, but I understand that it costs too much, that it's ineffective, and, you know, all efforts to fix this have failed. And so they opt for life without possibility of parole over the death penalty. And, you know, our polling shows that, 54% of the voters agree that it's time to replace the death penalty with life without possibility of parole.
The bishops, of course, are strongly in favor of what's on the ballot to change the death penalty. Catholics are about as divided as everybody else in the general population. Are other areas of the faith community getting involved on this?
Yes, we have within our own organization an effort called Thousand Congregations, and that is to have congregations support our effort to replace the death penalty, and we have more and more congregations doing so.
And has a field poll or any of those done some serious polling yet on this initiative?
Field poll has, and, you know, find that when voters are given the facts, they support the effort to replace the death penalty with life without possibility of parole. And, of course, there's more polling going on as we speak.
Have we? I'm trying to remember. Have we had the death penalty itself on the ballot in the last 10 or 15 years?
No. The last time the voters voted on the death penalty was 1978, which
wow.
is what put the death penalty in place in the state. So this is the first time that the voters will be able to vote on this issue knowing the facts about the death penalty, how much it cost, and all the other issues, including the issues of the possibility of executing an innocent person. Because we now know that 140 people across the United States have been exonerated on death rows.
Right.
And we also have learned with DNA that we can't believe everything we think.
Mm-hmm.
DNA has taught us a lot about some of the problems with our criminal justice system. There's just no criminal justice system that's perfect. And as great as ours is, it still has flaws that could lead to innocent people ending up on death row.
So you're relatively optimistic that this thing's got a shot at passing?
I'm very optimistic.
Good.
when given the facts, people realize that it's time to replace the death penalty. Because, you know, really, when you look at the science of corrections, what works is keeping police on the street.
Mm-hmm.
What works is solving crime. And when you have 46% of homicides and 56% of reported rapes going unsolved each year in the state of California, it's time to relook at how we spend our criminal justice dollars. What will keep our neighborhoods, our children safer is using our money to keep police on the street and solving unsolved crimes. And that's why this initiative does three simple things. It replaces the death penalty with life without possibility of parole. It requires all inmates serving life without possibility of parole to work and pay restitution to the victim's compensation fund. And finally, it sets aside $100 million over 3.5 years for the sole purpose of solving unsolved homicides and unsolved rapes. And that's really keeping Californians safer.
I think the second and third things you listed there are as compelling as the first.
I agree with you.
Just, I don't know if you have these figures, but the number of unsolved murders, what percent of murders go unsolved, let's say in California?
It's 40, on average 46% each year, 46%. And as you know, because of the budget crisis in the state of California, many, many cities are having to take police off the street. And that really is not the right approach to criminal justice. We know just looking at New York, when you put more police on the street, you actually make your communities much safer.
Absolutely.
And that's been New York's experience, and we need to reprioritize how we spend our criminal justice dollars in the state.
Where can people learn more about the facts and figures on the death penalty? Just somewhere they can, a website where they can go and go, okay, here are the facts.
Absolutely. They can go to www.safecalifornia.org, or they can also go to www.deathpenalty.org.
Very good. Jeannie Whitford, it is a pleasure and honor to have you on the program, and thanks for all you're doing on this critical issue.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. God bless. That's Jeannie Whitford, former head of the Department of Corrections, former warden at San Quentin, and now the head of Death Penalty Focus. And you're going to be hearing more and more about this as we go along. And we do know that, you know, the Catholic community is divided on this issue. The bishops are not divided on this issue. They've come out very strongly in favor of this initiative on the California ballot this November. But we'll talk more about it as we move on into the summer and the fall. We'll take a quick break here. We'll be back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy Ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and care for the poor and elderly. 100% of your contribution supports the Sisters of Mercy Ministry or ministries you choose. Give them a call, 916-851-2700, or visit supportmercyfoundation.org. We're also grateful for the generous underwriting of the program by the Catholic Counseling Agency, whose mission is to facilitate psychological and emotional well-being in the faith community by providing clinically appropriate and effective counseling and case management services. Give them a call, 916-792-9797, or online at admin@catholiccounselingagency.com. Mercy McMahon Terrace is located on beautiful grounds in East Sacramento, directly across from Sacred Heart Church and Mercy Hospital. Mercy McMahon offers independent and assisted living in a warm and caring community. You can call Nikki at 916-733-6510 or go online at mercymcmahonterrace.org. Hackard Law is a professional law corporation, the counsel to business families with over 35 years of legal experience. Mike Hackard brings practical experience coupled with innovation to the legal field. Give them a call, 916-313-3030. We certainly thank Hackard Law and all of our underwriting support for their long and longstanding and substantial support of the Bishop's Hour. We hope that you will support those who help to support us here at the Bishop's Hour. Well, our saint of the day is St. Augustine of Canterbury. In the year 596, some 40 monks set out from Rome to evangelize the Anglo-Saxons in England. Leading the group was Augustine, the prior of their monastery in Rome. Hardly had he and his men reached France when they heard stories of the ferocity of the Anglo-Saxons and of the treacherous waters of the English Channel. He returned to Rome and to the Pope who had sent them, St. Gregory the Great, only to be assured by him that their fears were groundless. They set out again. This time the group crossed the English Channel and landed in the territory of Kent, ruled by King Ethelbert, a pagan married to a Christian. Ethelbert received them kindly, set up a residence for them in Canterbury, and within the year, on Pentecost Sunday of 597, he himself was baptized. After being consecrated a bishop in France, Augustine returned to Canterbury, where he founded his see. He constructed a church and monastery near where the present cathedral, begun in 1070, now stands. As the faith spread, additional sees were established at London and Rochester. Laboring patiently, Augustine wisely heeded the missionary principles, quite enlightened for the time, suggested by Pope Gregory the Great. Purify rather than destroy pagan temples and customs. Let pagan rites and festivals be transformed into Christian feasts. Retain local customs as far as possible. The limited success Augustine achieved in England before his death in 605, a short 8 years after he arrived in England, would eventually bear fruit long after in the conversion of England. Augustine of Canterbury can truly be called the Apostle of England, a very human saint, St. Augustine of Canterbury.
This is Bishop Jaime Soto, and this is the Bishop Hour with Bob Dunning.
That's me. Welcome back. On Monday, this Monday, the 16th Annual Holy Strokes Golf Tournament taking place at the Northridge Country Club. You can go to Holy Strokes at stignatius.org, and that's great way to, they still need sponsors. You can still sign up. StIgnatiusSAC.org. Holy Strokes at StIgnatiusSAC.org. And that's Saint with SC. It will all take place at the beautiful Northridge Country Club this Monday. Lunch and dinner and golf beginning at 1 o'clock. They could use some sponsors, and you can also make it just to the dinner. Also, a week from Saturday, the 19th, Honor Our Mother, Bishop Soto, and the youth ministries from the Diocese of Sacramento. We're hosting a Mary's Hour at Immaculate Conception Parish here in Sacramento. Rosary procession with youth groups dramatizing the glorious mysteries. Prayer service honoring the multicultural images of Mary. A Mary crowning, a prayer for vocations, and then benediction, exposition, and adoration of the Blessed Sacrament. And you can call Kevin Staskow to learn all about it, 916-733-0152. Go to iCatholicYouth.com, and Immaculate Conception Parish is at 3263 First Avenue in Sacramento. Again, that's Saturday, May 19th, a week from Saturday, beginning at 10 a.m., running to 1 p.m. at Immaculate Conception Parish right here in Sacramento. And the Bishop Gagos yard sale goes on. It concludes this weekend, raising money for all the wonderful work of the Bishop Gagos Maternity Home. It's at 6423 Lang Avenue here in Sacramento. You can get out there and get some great items. Well, we're pleased to welcome in Jane Lee from God's Heart and Heart Health, you know.
It kind of all goes together.
It all goes together.
It all does.
Heart and Hands Ministry. Jane, good morning.
Thank you. It's good
Happy
to be here.
Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you. Thank you.
Do you have a favorite Mother's Day memory?
No, they're all great. It's just a blessing from who you mothered to who you birthed to who you didn't birth to who's in your neighborhood.
Do moms look forward to Mother's Day?
Oh my gosh, you're putting me on the spot
really,
here.
We look forward to it.
Do you?
But I've never.
Most
been a
of us
mom, you
at
know?
The end, most of us say it really ought to be Mother's Month, Mother's Year. It really needs to happen every day because
yeah,
mothers
right.
have influence. You know, as do fathers, and that's the work of God's Heart and Hands, is not to detract from fathers. When you have father involved, the family is healthier, the community is healthier.
Right.
But God's Heart and Hands seeks to restore this, remind us that motherhood is significant. And I was thinking with your previous caller talking about the people that are in prison, mothering, you know, that's what she's trying to do in a way, is to get them ready to go back into society, is to teach them the things that mothers do, that mothers have a place, and it's not that motherhood needs an external job and title and paycheck. It's the work of God's Heart and Hands is to bring back motherhood to the center of the family, to the center of the community, to the center of the world.
Well, and you know, the really sad thing about those who are incarcerated, going back to our conversation with Jenny Woodford a minute ago, is that a huge percentage of them came from broken families. I mean, it's just almost a straight line cause and effect.
Wow.
Of not that you can't have bad things happen out of a
right.
You know, a completely intact, wonderful family where the mom and dad did everything right, and somehow,
and that happens too,
somebody just
right.
goes off the deep end. But so often from a very young age, they did not have people in that home parenting them who held them up, like, raising this child is the most important job God has given me.
Right.
And I know there are many single parents doing heroic work and doing their mm-hmm. best, and through no fault of their own find themselves in that circumstance. And it's not a knock on that at all.
Uh-huh.
But it is very much cause and effect. If parents aren't in the home, both parents doing their best with those
right.
kids.
Right, and how they view it. It's
yeah,
how they view
it. So many, because, you know, beyond everything else, I can remember those times as an adolescent when it all starts. So much of whether I was going to go down that path or that path was, what would mom and dad think?
Right.
What would mom and dad say?
Right. And if we step back and look at the bigger picture, we've always had jails, prisons. We've always had that in humanity. The difference now I see is that the community aspect of motherhood has been diluted and set aside. We've somehow made mothers think they only mother their own, where in the mm-hmm. past it was, no, you mother the community.
Yeah, the old overworked expression, it takes a village to raise a child. But
yes.
I know, having grown up in a small town, that's what it was. If I was lippy to a teacher at school,
yes,
my dad got a phone call.
Or to a neighbor.
Yeah, I mean, nobody, you know, now if, you know, the neighborhood kid does something, people just kind of go, oh, it's not my business.
Right,
exactly. It's not my business. I'm not going to get involved. I'm going to get sued.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
I'm not going to get involved.
See, isn't that interesting how we, and that's where God's heart and hands comes in, is to shift it back. I was on a retreat last weekend at Christ the King Center, and ended up in a conversation at breakfast and was talking about motherhood and the work of God's heart and hands. And the woman next to me said, well, I'm not a mom. I don't mother anybody. And I said, you know, I would wonder what child crosses your path, what mothers cross your path. And in exploring that, she realized that she has a neighbor next door to her that is a young mother that she encourages, that she just sits there and listens to, that she shows her the emphasis, and how she's interacted with the kids in her neighborhood just by being, mm-hmm. just by holding the line, just by encouraging them, just by being interested in their lives, of what they can do, and so on. And at the end, she said, you know, I never thought I mothered anybody. And it's exactly what we're talking about, is that community aspect of mothering needs to return. Yep. You know, I've driven my husband nuts many a time because it's, I believe, mom to one, mom to all. You know, if I see I saw a child bullying another child at the swimming pool last night at the, you know, taking some kids there. I had to just, you know, encouraging, saying, you know, I think you really want to be a friend. Is there another way? Because I can see that child's uncomfortable. And the other child said yes, and kind of helped them work through that because the parents just didn't see it. And it's just that what comes across your path in viewing motherhood, if God will bring children across our path to be mothered, to be encouraged, to give life to their dreams, to hold a boundary, you know, interacting with I actually have classes in the extended day where kids play with Legos
mm-hmm.
and they get to do all of these things, and interacting with these children just to encourage them or say, no, let's do it this way, or how about this? Or one child stole a toy from another child, and how I have to, those kids don't know me. And especially when one child said he found it underneath something that was impossible for him to go get, knowing he was telling a lie, and how to facilitate the truth to come out in a comfortable way that he could get his needs met,
yeah.
realize he didn't need to lie, and the other child could get his toy back. And that's mothering, and that's the bigger global picture of mothering.
You just remind me, what, you know, like... Sometimes the lies are almost embarrassing. You know, you always say, come on, tell a better lie. You know, I got to teach you how to tell a better lie.
Right, but I can't, you know, I can't deal with it quite that way. So I've got to be very, you know, okay, God, give me the right words here to figure this out. But that's the work of Mother's Day, is acknowledging and returning motherhood back to the center of how do we interact with those children? How do we encourage? And we don't ever know In fact, one daycare provider had said to me, she's been doing it for 20 years. A child came back to her as an adult and said, "You were the only person that ever spoke to me with respect." And she didn't think anything of it. Mm-hmm. She just treated all the children this way. She just treated them with respect, and she saw whoever came across her path was who she was going to treat a certain way. And that's what this work is all about, is returning Mother's Day back to an influential, just recognize. You know what? Mothers have the influence either way.
Right.
But if we pay attention to it, perhaps we could get that 720 people that are on death row back down to zero, or like six, as she said. But we do impact. We do influence. We do. In fact, I heard on the radio this morning, somebody called in on one of the radio stations just talking about motherhood. And it was a grandma. You love grandma's advice because mm-hmm. they've been through it. They've done it. And now they've got the treasure, the jewels. They've got the clarity. And she said, it doesn't matter if you don't have any money on Mother's Day. It's the words. Mm-hmm. She said, your words, you love your children or disempower them by your word. You breathe life into their dreams, what they're going to do in the future, or if they'll be a success. Mothers have that influence. And that's what this is all about. And Mother's Day, although it's a Hallmark day, we have to remember that that's really, let's fully embrace it. Let's just not do flowers and brunch. Let's fully embrace it. It's big enough that we made a holiday out of it. That's the same, second Sunday in May every year, to pay attention to the fact that mothers influence humanity.
Yeah, and I know with our kids, and sometimes it's, you know, it's hard to integrate them, but we do our best to do it, is let's use the example of the greatest mother that ever walked the earth, mm-hmm. The Blessed Mother,
yes,
as an example of motherhood.
Yes, and let's, and coupled with that, Jesus is, some of the last words he spoke before he died, right, was anointing motherhood. Yeah. If he said everything, but what's thing?
We talk about, you know, honor your father and your mother. It's right there in the Ten Commandments.
Right.
Same thing. Of all the things Jesus could have said on the cross, he talked about his mother.
Yes, and isn't it interesting? He said to her, your mothering's not done. You will continue to mother. I need you to continue mothering. I think that's so fascinating. And then she to point out to her, to show her, he is your child. Mm-hmm. All of them are your child.
Right.
So taking motherhood back to really its foundation, to its roots, how much more God-ordained can we make motherhood and remind ourselves that we are significant, we are influential, you know, and kind of thinking to the criminal justice system, possibly there's a parallel here. At the same time, in the past decades, when we've been setting aside, diluting, splintering the influence of motherhood, our criminal justice system has exploded. Mm-hmm. You wonder if there's possibly some link there.
Exploded in numbers. It's just, it is. It's phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
How high it has gone. Jane, the time flew too fast today. We were going to talk about some other things, but we will talk about them the next time.
Okay. Thank you.
Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Very quickly before we go on this beautiful Friday, the great golf tournament coming up Monday the 21st, all to benefit three great charities, the Breast Cancer Diagnostic Services of All Be Aware, the Developmental Disabilities Camp Recreation, sponsored by the Diocese of Sacramento, and the St. Vincent de Paul Society of Divine Savior Parish. The golf tournament will take place Monday the 21st. It's all sponsored by Council 13672 of the Knights of Columbus. It's going to be at Cate Verdera Country Club at 12 Bridges in Lincoln. And it is just going to be a great day of fun and raise some money for some truly great causes. You can call 91 if you want to sign up, or if you want to help donate, sponsor, call 916-749-2555 or 916-987-0455 or go to the website 2012kctg.com. That's going to do it for us for today. Happy Mother's Day, everyone. Honor your mother. Honor the Blessed Mother as well. We'll talk to you again on Monday.
You brought me back to life. Healed my broken heart. You've given me my sight. You've taken me by storm. Gave it all away to come and rescue me.